So when we're talking about an overview of the book of Ruth, there's maybe a couple of things to keep in mind by way of introduction. I think for a lot of people, this is one of their favorite books of the Bible. It's a simple story. It's a beautiful story. It has a lot of charm and character to it. One literary critic observes that this is one of the few really successful examples of a story that holds your interest, that you get involved and invested in, and yet there are no villains. Some people are less good than others, but you don't run into any real jerks in the book of Ruth. You know, there's people who maybe don't do everything they should, but you're not running into the sort of horrible narratives that you find in the book of Judges, for instance. And that by itself is already very interesting because Ruth comes after Judges in our Bibles. And of course, it begins by saying, now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. And isn't that a comfort? You know, you read through Judges and especially those last five chapters, it's easy to come out of those feeling beat up because the appalling reality of sin among the professing people of God is so clear. You have idolatry and superstition and betrayal and violence. You have a Benjamite town that's described in language that reminds us of the language used for Sodom. And this is all happening where supposedly the Lord's name is known. So it's such a relief to come out of Judges and into Ruth and realize, but there was another side to things as well. There were people who feared the Lord. There were people who behaved uprightly, not perfectly, but sincerely. Now, in terms of an outline, Ruth is really pretty simple. There's four main parts to it, and then you've got a prologue and an epilogue. So we can outline Ruth in 6 points. And this is adapted from the Reformation Heritage Study Bible. There's a prologue, verses 1 through 5, where you have a background of disaster. In other words, it's setting up the scenario. Most of the action of the book takes place within about a 90-day period from barley harvest to wheat harvest, but this opening part presumably covers a much longer period of time, several years, where a family from Bethlehem moves to Moab. The sons are married, the husband and the sons die, and that's kind of where we pick up then in verse 6. So the first 5 verses cover a lot of territory and set up a background of disaster. Naomi and Ruth and Orpah are, we zoom in on them, we focus on them, we start to follow their story more closely after they've been through some really difficult experiences. So that's the prologue, the background of disaster. Then the rest of chapter 1, verses 6 through 22, is about Naomi's return home, back to Bethlehem, and who goes with her, which Ruth does, Orpah does not. Chapter 2, then, is about securing basic survival. They get to Bethlehem. People are like, is this Naomi? She's like, oh, don't call me Naomi, which means pleasant. Call me Mara. Call me bitter or embittered. Well, in chapter 2, Ruth takes the initiative and goes out to make a living, to provide for herself and for her mother-in-law. In the next part, in chapter 3, verses 1 through 18, it's not just about bare survival. Now it's about seeking rest. It's about finding a permanent, a stable, sustainable situation. And then in chapter 4, verses 1 through 16, you see how that works out into full redemption. Redemption for Ruth, but also redemption for Naomi. And then in the epilogue, chapter 4, verses 17 through 22, you have the upshot or the outcome of this redemption. So in terms of a summary of the plot, well, a man and his family leave Bethlehem. And it's sometimes important, it's often important in the Bible to pay attention to the meaning of names. Bethlehem means the house of bread or the storehouse of food. Why do they leave the storehouse of food? It's a little ironic, isn't it? There was a famine. The house of bread, the storehouse of food, there was nothing to eat. So they went to Moab. Now, how severe the famine was, how long it lasted, were they the only people who went away? We don't really know. But this might remind you of Abraham and Isaac, who also moved around in response to famine conditions. And of course, it might remind you of Jacob and his family who went down to Egypt because of the famine in the land. It's something that God's people have done, but when you think about it, it usually didn't work out terribly well for them. And of course, Naomi leaves Bethlehem, and we're not told her name right away, but this man, his wife, their two sons leave the house of bread. They go to a foreign country to make a living, to survive, and disaster strikes. Now, Naomi survives, but out of the original group that left Bethlehem, she's the only one. She's the only one who can go back. Well, they'd married while in Moab. This is one of the reasons to think that it probably took a little while. I mean, they didn't arrive in Moab and get married the next day, probably. And then the husbands died. Why all of the men died, we don't know. We're not told that information. But what happens is then there are three widows and no children. Well, what kind of an image does that give you? Here's Naomi, a foreigner in Moab. Two daughters-in-law, all the husbands are dead, there are no children. In terms of that culture, in terms of that society, they have no future. They cannot expect anything good ever to happen again. So Naomi says, well, I'm going to go back home. Her daughters-in-law say that they'll go with her, but she argues with them. She says, why? I can't do anything for you. I'm destitute. The Lord has taken everything away from me. And Orpah listens and goes back to her father's household, and we lose sight of her. We don't know what happened next. Did she remarry? All of that. We don't know. But Ruth refuses to go away. In verse 16, she says, of chapter 1, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. And that sets up a clue that is going to be picked up on and answered more fully. What was Ruth's motivation here? Well, it's going to be described as steadfast love or covenant loyalty, that Hebrew word hesed. But you notice that Ruth has taken the Lord to be her God. And that clue is also going to be picked up on. Boaz is going to tell her that she's come to take refuge under the Lord's wings. So Ruth has undergone what you might call a religious conversion. Is that why the Lord sent Naomi and her husband Elimelech to Moab? That's certainly one good thing that came out of it. Had they not gone to Moab, what are the odds that Ruth would have heard the truth, that she would have come to know the Lord? So that's worth thinking about a little bit. Now, when they get back to Bethlehem, as I indicated, the women, you know, who remembered Naomi from some years before, were excited. Is this Naomi? Naomi's come back. She's like, yeah, but you can't call me that. The Lord has dealt bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. That was her thought. She went out full. That seems a little bit unrealistic, because why did they go out? They went out because of famine. They went out because they weren't full. But she is coming back with less than she had when she went out in terms of family. Well, while Naomi languishes in sorrow, Ruth goes out to work, to provide for their needs. She came to the field of Boaz, and Boaz had heard about her, and they have a little bit of interaction and dialogue, and Boaz instructs her to glean in his fields, to take from the food that he provides for his servants, and to stay close to his people so that she'll be protected from harm and from danger. And so, as it says at the end of chapter 2, verse 23, so she stayed close by the young woman of Boaz to glean until the end of barley harvest and wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law. Now, Naomi's spirit has revived a little bit as she's seen the Lord providing for them through Ruth's hard work and through Boaz's generosity. And so now Naomi starts to think about, what can she do for Ruth? You remember when she was talking to her daughters-in-law, she said, I can't do anything for you. If I had a husband and would conceive tonight, were you going to wait for another set of sons to grow up and marry them? She feels like a person without a future, with no prospects, with no hope. Now, having been cared for, having been ministered to, she's starting to revive a little bit, and she starts to think about what she can do for others. And so she plays the matchmaker. She chooses an auspicious opportunity. She helps Ruth to get ready, and she sends Ruth to have a private, discreet interview with Boaz, where Boaz is asked to spread his garment over Ruth. In other words, to take her under his protection, in short, to marry her. Boaz is willing to do that. And he's willing to do that because all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. Chapter 3, verse 12. Now, there's an interesting little sidelight here. In our Bibles, of course, Ruth comes after Judges because Ruth takes place during that time period. But in many copies of the Hebrew Bible, Ruth comes after Proverbs. Now, Proverbs 31 ends in chapter 31. It's not the very last part of the chapter, but it's there at the end, towards the end. There's a poem about a virtuous woman. Now, that poem about the virtuous woman in Proverbs chapter 31 clearly has in mind somebody with a high rank, somebody who has prosperity from an upper class social station. And if you were reading the Bible in Hebrew, you read Proverbs 31, and then you came to the book of Ruth, you'd read about another woman who was a woman of virtue, but who was not from a high social class. She's working with the lowest of the laborers. She's out gleaning in the fields. And so that juxtaposition is interesting because it tells you that being a woman of virtue, and in more general terms, being a person of virtue, does not depend on having rank or wealth or standing. It is first and foremost a question of character. And Ruth has that character. She's a foreigner. She's on the low end of the social scale, but she is a woman of worth. There are differences socially and so forth, but in character, she's just like the Proverbs 31 woman. There's a living example, if you will. So Boaz is willing to do this, but there is a problem. There's a difficulty. According to the laws and customs of the time, there's somebody who has a more immediate right of redemption. That introduces one of the key ideas of the book, which is the right of redemption. Now, you might remember under Israelite law, if somebody fell into difficulties, it might be that they'd mortgaged their land, it might be that they themselves had entered indentured servitude, it might be that somebody had been unjustly put to death. And so you'd have the figure of the kinsman redeemer, the goel, to give you the Hebrew expression for it. And it was his responsibility to be the avenger of blood. If you're reading the Bible and you come across the title, the avenger of blood, that's the goel. That's the kinsman redeemer. If you come across the title kinsman redeemer, it's the same word for the avenger of blood. But they're being looked at from two different perspectives. One had, in the one scenario, this person had the responsibility to see that justice was carried out for the family. In the other scenario, he had the responsibility to do what was possible for improving the situation of the family. And so if you'd had to mortgage your land, a relative, somebody who was qualified for that role, could come along and help you get it back out from under its mortgage or from being leased to somebody else. If you'd sold yourself into indentured servitude, somebody could come along and pay the price and acquire your freedom for you. And that was one of the ways that redemption happened in Israel. It gave them a concrete illustration. What is this concept? What does it mean? But of course, then there was a hierarchy. A more remote family member could exercise the right of redemption, but only if nearer family members were not in a position to or refused to. So Boaz has this virtuous woman that he'd like to marry. He needs to free Naomi's lands from their leases so that the profit of those can go to her. And he wants to hold those two things together. But somebody else has a prior claim. Now, interpreters have different reconstructions of this because we're not fully familiar with all of the mechanics of how the different things worked. So I'm going to give you the approach that seems most plausible to me. When Boaz comes and talks to this fellow, and this fellow is unknown. He's a closer relative to Naomi than Boaz is, but we don't even know his name. He's anonymous in this book. So Boaz finds him in the city gate. There's witnesses sitting around, and he said, it says, where is that? Verse 1, Boaz said, "Come aside, friend." Another way to translate would be to say, "Come aside, so-and-so." It's just a very, very generic term, like, "Hey, you." Because we're not told this guy's name because he disappears. He refused to use the right of redemption, and he vanishes from Scripture. Anyway, Boaz says, "Come aside, hey, you." And so they draw things up with the witnesses there. And he said, "Naomi sold the piece of land which belonged to her brother Elimelech. I was going to let you know so you can buy it back. If you'll redeem it, that's fine. If not, I'll redeem it." And the guy says, "I'll redeem it." Well, what is he thinking? Well, he's thinking, this is a reconstruction. Some of the details could be a little bit different, but this is what I'm proposing. He's thinking, Naomi is childless. When I redeem this land in her name, after she's gone, it will come to me. It will be added to my overall inheritance that I'm going to share with my children. So he's like, "Yeah, I'll jump on that. That sounds like a good opportunity." And then Boaz introduces a wrinkle and says, "Now, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance." Verse 5. Now there's a wrinkle. If Ruth has children, that first son that she would have would carry on Elimelech's name, and on Naomi's death, the land would go to that child rather than being incorporated in Heyu's territory. So Heyu doesn't want to go for that. He doesn't like that idea. So I said, "Nope, I can't do that." Let's see, what does he say? "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance." That's our clue to his motivations. What if Ruth only has one child, and instead of his name being perpetuated, it's Elimelech's name that is perpetuated? There's all sorts of little wrinkles that might come up. You don't know what the future holds. So he's like, "Nope, too risky." And so Boaz gets the property. Boaz gets the girl. And obviously, in this case, we know that the girl does not mind. So they're married, and the Lord blesses Ruth with fruitfulness. And notice this. This is significant. Verse 14. "Then the woman said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a close relative, without a kinsman redeemer. May his name be famous in Israel. May he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons, has borne him.' Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him." You know, we call this book the Book of Ruth, but in some ways, Naomi is really the main character. And so blessings abound for her, where she had considered herself empty through Ruth and through Boaz, but through Ruth, now she has a nourisher, a sustainer of her old age. The child who was born is considered her redeemer. the one who takes care of her. So it's a good story, right? It's something you can read in a few minutes, and it holds your interest. It's very engaging, and it's absolutely worthwhile to read and reread Ruth. So let's talk a little bit about its contribution. Why is this story in Scripture? Well, people will find different things in Ruth depending on how they read it. For instance, if you read the book of Ruth from a political standpoint, you notice how it ends. It ends with a genealogy that culminates in David. So from a political standpoint, this book explains that David's Moabite ancestor, Ruth, was in fact an Israelite indeed. She converted. She was a virtuous woman. So there's that element to it. From a standpoint of examples, we're reading this story to be inspired and instructed on how to behave. Here's a summary that I found in one of the books I consulted. Common people achieve uncommon ends when they act unselfishly toward each other. You know, that is not a bad lesson to take away from the book of Ruth. If that's all you get from Ruth, you're missing some of it. But that's a good lesson to take away. We're just ordinary people. At least most of us are ordinary people. Can we accomplish anything uncommon? Can we accomplish anything extraordinary? Well, the right way to do that is unselfish behavior towards one another. Think about how unselfish Ruth is towards Naomi, for instance. And she's included in the line of David, ultimately in the line of the Messiah. But what about from an experiential or an existential standpoint? What if we read Ruth and are relating it to our own experience? Well, you can get something out of Ruth on that line as well. If you do that, I'd suggest focusing on Naomi as the main character. Plot the story of Naomi, and what do you see? You see that the Lord took Naomi from emptiness and bitterness to fullness and blessing. And he did it through human instruments who demonstrated chesed, who demonstrated steadfast love, or covenant loyalty, or loving kindness, as that word is sometimes translated. But what if you look at it from a theological standpoint? This book is in the Bible, after all. It's teaching us about God, isn't it? Well, sure it is. From a theological standpoint, you can see that God's providence may be difficult, but in the lives of his people, it is ultimately gracious. Naomi went through a really hard time. But what came out of it? What came out of it was a Moabite converted to the Lord, made into a virtuous woman, and included in the ancestry of the Messiah. Was it worth the suffering for that outcome? Well, in a sense, we're not the ones to make that determination. God is. But God thought it was worth it. Well, in our own lives, then, we can draw that lesson. God's providence is difficult. But what's the end of the Lord? Well, it's a gracious purpose. However, more fully, reading Ruth as part of the history of redemption, we can say this. Ruth and Boaz, who join to form the line of David, and therefore ultimately the line of Christ, anticipate the ultimate redeemer. Boaz is a redeemer. Boaz's son is a redeemer of Naomi's old age. But you know who else is a redeemer? Ruth is a redeemer. The women of Bethlehem say to Naomi that Ruth is better than seven sons. Why? Well, she's the key. She's the instrument of blessing. Boaz does a lot. But would Boaz have done any of that without Ruth? Probably not. I mean, we don't have any reason to think that he would. So it shows you, in a sense, the bitterness of Naomi when she says, I went out full and the Lord has brought me back empty. Like, Ruth is standing right next to you. I mean, show a little consideration. You're not empty. You have the Bible's most amazing daughter-in-law. That is not nothing. That's something to be very thankful for. But Naomi is too bitter, too sad, too consumed with her own problems to see it. But ultimately, who's the key to unlocking a good future for Naomi? It is, in fact, Ruth, whom she completely overlooked in the moment. And the women of Bethlehem don't overlook it. They see the value that Ruth had. So Boaz shows you one side of redemption. He shows you the rescuing. He shows you the acting from a place of power, which Christ does in our case. But Ruth shows you the other side. How does she redeem Naomi? She redeems Naomi by bearing the burden, by going out into the heat of the day and plucking grain and then walking home with 40 plus pounds of grain on her back. That's how Ruth redeems. Well, you see two sides of the work of Christ there then, don't you? You see the work of Christ bearing our burden, suffering in our place, doing what we should be doing. But you also see Christ authoritatively, powerfully rescuing us from our enemies, redeeming us from our bondage. So there's the two sides there. Now, when I say that there's these different ways to read Ruth, somebody might say, wait, hold on a moment. We know perfectly well as Reformed people that the meaning of Scripture is not manifold, but one. Yes, the meaning of Scripture is one, but it's not flat. It's not one-dimensional. And so we see a number of truths out of the book of Ruth. We see that even in the dark times of the Judges, there were oases of piety. And while inside of those bubbles of godliness, if you want to call them that, I mean, there's quite a difference between Bethlehem and Shiloh. Within those bubbles of godliness, there are problems, but they are handled with faith and they are handled with kindness. Well, that gives us an ambition. That gives us something to aim for. Maybe we can't change the world, but can we create an oasis of godliness in our home, in our church? That's something worth aiming for. Will there be problems there? Yes, there will. Can we tackle them with faith and kindness? We should be able to. We have the resources to be able to. The question is that, in fact, our approach? Or secondly, of course, we see in Ruth what loyalty and what conversion look like. She chooses the Lord to be her God, and she goes to Bethlehem to seek for refuge under his wings. That's who she trusts. And because she trusts the Lord, she's able to be so persistent, so patient, so long-suffering with Naomi and all of Naomi's problems. She's a woman of worth. We see in Boaz that when you have a man of means with a godly character, he can make a big impact. It sets before us some of the potential of what we could do as the Lord blesses us. We see a portrait in Naomi of how we sometimes respond to disaster, how we can be oblivious to blessings. But we also see that people didn't give up on her and that the Lord brought her out of that. We learn about basic human needs and how God has provided for them to be met on a natural level as well as on a spiritual level. They get to Bethlehem. What do they need? Well, they need food. And the Lord provided for that. Ruth goes out and works. But you also see the wider needs, the emotional needs. Naomi's heart is comforted when Ruth has rest and then when she has a grandchild that she's taken care of. It speaks to the realities of human nature and how all of the answers to our needs come from the Lord's hands. And then finally, very quickly, we see that the quality of steadfast love, of hesed, is the key to solving the problems, even the problems that we have created. We look to God for refuge, like Ruth, because he is love. And he uses us to bring blessing to others as we learn to love the way he does.